And now, as if candy composting isn't enough to keep in mind, here's something else to consider this Halloween. It's never fun when your creative and witty costume falls flat or just gets you shrugs from the partygoers. But what happens when your outfit isn't just not funny, but it's perceived by some as downright racist or sexist? Joining us to talk about this is Carmen Van Kerkhove. She publishes the blog Love Isn't Enough about race and parenting and the blog Racialicious about race and pop culture. Hi there, Carmen. Welcome to Tell Me More.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with a recent post on Racialicious. Your blog editor, LaToya Peterson, wrote this: Halloween is an exhausting time for us wee anti-racist critics. When everyone else gets to dress up and have a good time, we wind up at home either sifting through online images of people dressed up as racists and growing more bitter and gnarled by the minute. That's a depressing picture. Can you explain how it is that a night that's supposed to be fun can really cause such anxiety for some?
Well, if you think about it, you know, Halloween costumes are often based on the things that we as a society either have anxiety about, we see as taboo or abnormal. So there's a reason that not a lot of people dress up as, for example, a middle-class white man who's an insurance manager and has two kids and a dog. That's not an interesting costume because it's quote-unquote normal. And so a lot of the costumes out there will deal with sex, with violence, with death. And then also you see a lot of costumes that show sort of marginalized identities, you know, people of color, different cultures.
Give me a list. Give me some examples. If someone, you open the door and there's a kid in what, it's going to make you feel weird.
Oh, boy. Stereotypical Mexican with a big poncho and a big mustache, geisha, and then any number of sexy blank ethnicity. So sexy harem girl, sexy Native American, sexy, you know, as one of our bloggers laughed, said sexy Shaolin monk. Any of those are going to definitely raise an eyebrow for me.
But now, is a lot of this, you know, is it racism or is this just simple ignorance? People don't get it.
Well, I think this is something that, you know, a lot of people just haven't thought about. And, you know, quite frankly, I myself, not too many years ago, dressed up as a Native American, you know, just because I had a fringy suede vest and a fake suede skirt. And I thought that would be, you know, an easy and cheap costume to do. So a lot of people just haven't thought about this. But I think once you think about how, you know, this, you know, the kind of implications that this has, then I think it's important to you know, change your behavior. You know, one of the bloggers that we linked to on Racialicious wrote, for example, when did it become okay to reduce the diversity, language, culture of nearly 500 different indigenous tribes into a tacky costume of cheap suede, colored feathers, plastic beads, and fringe? So I think one element is that it's kind of insulting if you're from a culture to see that very complex culture boiled down into this caricature.
Well, you know, we put out a call for comments on our Facebook page, and Brigitte Brent wrote back, do blacks have a monopoly on pimps, prostitutes, rappers, inmates, or maids? I think some people definitely overreact to Halloween costumes. Is it overreaction?
It depends on your perspective. You know, I think that one of the problems with dressing up as someone from a different background is that you get to sort of live as them for a day, walk in their shoes for a day, but with none of the institutional oppression that they have to face. So, for example, you can go as a so-called gangster from the hood with baggy jeans and, you know, whatever else are the accoutrements of that particular costume, but you don't have to be racially profiled by the police. You know, you can go as a harem girl or an Arab sheikh, and you don't have to be racially profiled at the airport. And so it's really a way of getting to dress up, but, you know, you deal with everything but the burden.
You know, one of your bloggers wrote in about how when she was a little girl, she was so excited because her mother dressed her up in a beautiful Native costume from her home country, Trinidad. She got to wear makeup and she arrived at school so proud and excited. And then all the kids thought she was Aunt Jemima from the maple syrup bottle, or the little slave girl in the movie Roots, and she was crushed. Do you have advice for parents?
Well, I would say that example shows how much we are really affected by the stereotypes that we take in, so that even if we see a costume, we immediately categorize it into something that we're familiar with, you know, the Aunt Jemima, the slave girl. And so I would say to parents, you know, it's not about staying away from race altogether. I mean, you know, I'll give you a few examples of costume ideas that I thought were great that played with race but didn't necessarily go into being offensive. A blogger that I know who's a Chinese American guy, and he has a daughter, and she was about, I think, 4 or 5 years old. And last year he dressed her up as an underage Chinese gymnast. So he put a fake birth certificate on her back claiming she was 16. And that was funny, you know?
I think we have to leave it there. Carmen Van Kerkhove is the publisher of Love Isn't Enough, a blog about race and parenting, and Racialicious, a blog about race and pop culture. She joined us from NPR in New York. And that's our program for today. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today we're starting a series of stories about privacy, or as we are calling the series, The End of Privacy. NPR's Martin Kosty is here with us at NPR West. Martin, that title is your idea. You're calling it The End of Privacy, so the message there, forget about privacy. It's over.
Well, it's not necessarily what I'm saying, but what struck me over the last couple of years as I've done stories about privacy is how many people say this to me. They say they've given up. The technologies have become too fast. They're too good at collecting data. And in some ways, I'm hearing a lot of people say that they've sort of succumbed to what I'm calling privacy fatalism.
Privacy fatalism sounds like a pretty gloomy future to me.
Well, it's what we're going to try to look at in this series to see if that fatalism is justified. And I think a good place for us to start today is just looking at what kind of information is really out there. So, for instance, you've got a computer in front of you here in the studio. Take a look at this website. Type in nextmark.com.
Nextmark.com.
And when you look there, you see that it's a searchable site. It's sort of the Google of mailing lists. Put in a search term, let's say something medical, because that's what people care about. Bladder, perhaps?
Bladder, okay.
That might lead to
searching
something.
Searching all mailing lists for bladder, coming up with bladder leakage database, bladder sufferers, all kinds of.
Now, these are
like
not just statistics. These are lists of people's names, their addresses, their phone numbers sometimes, tied in with their medical conditions, sometimes medical conditions that I would assume they would not want necessarily for sale, and yet here they are for sale. This has always happened in the past, of course. There's always been ways for marketers to get information about, say, our medical conditions from warranty cards for things we fill out or magazine subscriptions. But all of that is accelerating, and what we have now is sort of a switch from dial-up speeds to broadband speeds for the flow of this information into this vast data pool.
We should say I don't see the names popping up here. I would have to pay money to have access.
You would have
to
pay money.
To
you can pay. You can buy per thousand and so forth. It's definitely a commodity.
Are there regulations, Martin, on how much information these companies can collect, what kind of information they can gather?
Not really. This kind of data is pretty much unregulated in the United States. It's not legal for your doctor or your hospital to sell your medical data, of course. That is prohibited by federal law. But if you voluntarily give up your information, all the law cares about is where the information came from. Now, the industry, of course, is very adamant that it's careful, that the reputable firms aren't selling this information to just anybody. Yes, you can look at the website and see that it's for sale, but they still want to know more about you before they sell it to you. I actually called the founder and CEO of Nextmark, the site you were looking at there. His name is Joe Pitch. And he said that consumers should also keep in mind that there are some benefits to companies knowing more about us.
I think when it's done right, just as with a good friend, sharing personal information makes for a much more relevant and meaningful relationship. And without that, you're really just a number.
And this is really the crux of the issue, because people do use their personal information to get stuff, to get good relationships with companies, to get coupons, bonuses, that sort of thing. They trade their personal information. And they do it to the point where it's actually becoming a subject for economists.
Those exchanges happen daily, constantly.
That's Alessandro Acquisti. He's an Italian economist who specializes in privacy. And the way he sees things, personal information is almost a kind of currency. It's something we spend. But there's a problem.
We don't have infinite cognitive power and processing power to consider all the different options. And we take shortcuts.
Acquisti studies these shortcuts that we take. He studies how people make gut decisions about which information to disclose about themselves. For example, online. It turns out that, according to his experiments, we're influenced by website design.
people admit more sensitive, even embarrassing or illegal behaviors to a website which has been designed to look kind of cheesy.
In his experiments, he's found that subjects are more likely to admit to, say, cheating on their girlfriend or something when the questions are on this cheesy, fun-looking website. But a more formal-looking website asking the same questions gets a lot more caution and a lot more self-censorship.
So, Martin, you're saying that people sometimes will decide whether they want to share their information based on a gut instinct, but you could also be pretty rational about this, I suppose. You could read a company privacy policy and make an informed decision about what you're disclosing.
That's very true, and some people make that effort. They read the fine print. But even the experts, the people who are privacy gurus, say that's becoming harder to do. Because you may see a privacy policy there, but it's pretty much impossible in most situations to know where your data is going if they are sending it anywhere. It's hard to follow it through the system. Chris Hufnagel is the head of privacy programs at Berkeley Law, and he explained some of this to me.
As there's been growing awareness of how commercial data brokers operate, they've become more secretive.
We were talking in a park in San Francisco a few weeks ago, and when we met, Chris immediately opened up his laptop because he wanted to show me something.
This is an archive.
He's been saving screenshots of the websites of the big data companies over time. He's been saving screenshots of what they say about where their data is coming from. The formal term for this is data provenance. As recently as 2002, in his screenshots there, you can see that this particular data company still disclosed some details about the commercial sources of the data. It listed things like call centers or pizza delivery companies that sold information to them. But lately, that's changed.
As time goes on, this gets thinner and thinner. So pizza companies falls off the list. And then by 2006, the provenance is gone.
Nothing listed for provenance?
They basically say things like, the process includes proprietary files. That essentially means it's sources that they've gathered, but they won't tell you what those sources are.
Now, it should be noted that data brokers have good business reasons to keep their sources secret. They may be trade secrets or something the other guy hasn't discovered. But Hufnagel also believes that there is some political motivation behind this.
If consumers knew the extent to which this information was being collected and repackaged, there would be riots in the streets.
Riots in the streets?
Yeah, it's a bit of an overstatement, and, you know, he cares deeply about these things. But there is some truth to the fact that American privacy laws have traditionally been driven by scandals. That's why, for example, we have federal protections for our video rental records. It's because there was a dust-up in the 80s because someone published the lineup for Judge Robert Bork's personal movie nights.
Oh, right.
So that's why we have that protection. It's always about a scandal. And now as data companies are beginning to extend their reach into interesting new areas, like social networks, it's probably a smart thing to keep some of those new sources below the radar.
You're talking about social networks like Facebook, for example. How valuable would that kind of data be?
Well, you remember how Alessandro Quisti was talking about the cheese factor?
Yes.
Well, the fact is that people are less inhibited about themselves on informal websites. And that's true on social sites especially. And data companies now know that. They want that information that you're sharing so freely about yourself on social sites. And that's what tomorrow's story is all about.
Okay, NPR's Martin Kosty, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can find more from our series, The End of Privacy, at npr.org. There's a breakdown of some of the costs and rewards of sharing your personal information.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the computer world, Apple is often seen as the king of cool, or at least that's what its commercials suggest.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
I'm into doing fun stuff like movies, music, podcasts, stuff like that.
I also do fun stuff like timesheets and spreadsheets and pie charts.
Okay, no, by fun I mean more in terms of, for example, it'd be kind of hard to capture a family vacation.
That sense of style extends to Apple's more than 200 retail stores, and now those stores face some competition. This week, Microsoft opened its first store in Scottsdale, Arizona. For member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Mark Brody reports.
There was definitely build-up Thursday morning at Scottsdale Fashion Square. Employees of the new Microsoft store led chants with a long line of customers waiting for the opening.
3, 2, 1, welcome to the Microsoft store!
Jason Claiborne of Mesa owns an IT company. He'd been waiting at the mall for almost 18 hours.
A little curiosity to see what they're going to try to roll out to beat, you know, Apple stores because they're all fancy and stuff.
More than a few of Claiborne's fellow line waiters had an iPhone or Apple laptop to help them pass the time, and that's one of the challenges for Microsoft, according to Mary Jo Foley. She blogs about the company on ZDNet, a network of computer and technical blogs.
I think they've got to get people convinced that Microsoft's cool and you'd want to go to a Microsoft store and that you'd gain value from going there as opposed to going wherever you usually buy a PC.
There was some debate before Thursday's opening about how much the new Microsoft store would look like an Apple store. And once the curtain came down, it was kind of similar. Employees in different brightly colored T-shirts helped customers. There were tables displaying computers, phones, music players, and cameras, and at the back of the store, an answer bar. Microsoft's Mika Kramer is heading up the merchandising and marketing for the new store.
Apple's a great retailer. Microsoft will be a great retailer, too, and it's all about Microsoft extending its relationship with its customers.
Ann Kramer says Microsoft has a specific goal in mind.
We're hoping that it'll establish that customer engagement, that relationship and that conversation with customers that we haven't had before. We sell through partners and we love our partners, but we actually now get a chance to engage one-on-one with our customers.
I don't know that this is a high-risk venture for them.
That's Seattle-based consultant Scott Bedbury. He advises companies on how to promote their brands.
But I think it's a high gain potential in terms of having them develop for the first time, truly, a direct feedback loop between end users and the company.
One of those end users is Tyler Rockwood. He was among the first in line to get into the store.
It makes it a lot easier for people to get their products rather than ordering it online or going somewhere else. Like, they got one place they can come to get it all.
Thursday's grand opening in Scottsdale coincided with Microsoft's launch of the new Windows 7. The company also plans to open a second store in Mission Viejo, California, next week. For NPR News, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix.
Well, now for more on e-reading, our all-tech-considered expert Omar Gayaga is here. He covers technology culture for the Austin American-Statesman. Welcome back, Omar.
Hi, Robert. Good to talk to you.
Have you sprung for an e-reader, by the way, yourself?
I have not. Not yet. I'm not a subway or rail commuter, but if I was, I would probably get one. Or if I were a student who was juggling lots of heavy textbooks, I would probably go ahead and make the jump.
Now, the Kindle is out there. The Sony machines are out there. Now, Barnes & Noble is going to introduce the Nook, which I gather has some new features. What's different about the Nook from other e-readers?
It has, in addition to the standard 6-inch e-reader display, a color display right below it. So it's got an additional second screen that will be more like a traditional LCD screen where you'll be able to see book covers in full color. And it also has a new feature called Lend Me, which allows you to lend out a copy of an ebook to a friend. Unfortunately, you can only do that one time with one book, and you have no access to that book while it's lent out. So that's one advantage over the Kindle, but it is very limited, and publishers can also opt not to allow you to lend out a particular book.
Now, people talk about this holiday season as being a time when lots of people will buy these e-readers. How many do they expect, and who's buying them?
The last 2 years, as e-books have kind of taken off and e-book readers like the Kindle have been introduced, it's been primarily older readers, people who are voracious bookworms. But it seems like that market is expanding. Forrester Research expects that 3 million ebook readers like the Kindle will be sold this year. And by the end of next year, they expect 10 million ebook readers will have been sold. And I think some of that has to do probably with a Barnes & Noble reader, which will probably do very well.
Do people in the industry talk about the inevitability of people ultimately reading with e-readers as opposed to hard copy books? I guess we have to have a new word for books.
Well, I think so. I mean, there's definitely the trade-off. You know, there's the portability and convenience of e-books versus the tactile sensation of a regular book, which there's been no duplication of that yet. You still don't have the same look and feel of books yet. But I don't think it's a fad either. I think publishers are definitely acknowledging that this is the future. And, you know, if you're comparing it to music, which was a relatively swift transition to digital music, books are definitely much more entrenched, I think, than the music industry. So I think it's going to be a much longer transition.
If I buy an e-reader and I then buy lots of books which I read on it, let's say I trade up for a different e-reader or I give the e-reader to my daughter, do the books convey with it? Can I keep the book somewhere else? Can I just lend a particular book and say, why don't you read this? I just read it. Take a look at this one.
Well, that's been a big knock against the Kindle is that if you have a Kindle and they have a Kindle, there's no easy way to lend a book or resell a book once you're done with it. But you can definitely give a device to someone. And there are now ways that you can read that same ebook on, say, an iPhone or on a computer screen. Amazon just announced they're coming out with a Windows e-reader application where you'd be able to read those same ebooks on your computer screen. You can already read them on your iPod or iPhone. You own that content, so you should be able to read it in whatever format, whether it's on the ebook reader itself or on some other screen that you own.
But to go back to where you began, this is a device that you, for example, associate with mobility. If you were taking a train to and from work, you would want to have this. If you're doing your reading in bed at night and your book is on the nightstand, what's the matter with a book?
Well, nothing at all. In fact, that's how I tend to consume most of my books still. But I also find myself more and more reading news articles and magazine articles on my phone in bed. You know, I'm lying there with my little tiny screen and still able to digest kind of smaller content like that. So I think when people think of the Kindle and think of some of the other ebook readers, they think primarily about books. But these are also ebook readers for newspapers. You can also read magazine articles on these. You can also read blogs on the Amazon Kindle. So I think definitely for shorter form content, people are going to be, you know, curled up in bed with them as well, and not just these, you know, 1,000-page novels.
Thank you, Omar.
Thanks for having me. And we'll be posting links to a lot of information about these devices on the Alltech Considered blog, and that's at npr.org/alltech.
Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for Alltech Considered. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And speaking of anonymity, we got a provocative comment on our website about this series, The End of Privacy. Listener Michael Robinson of Knoxville, Tennessee, made this observation: how very ironic that Martin Costi's story about online privacy is posted on NPR's website, which is embedded with 7 tracking cookies from marketing and behavioral targeting companies. Well, we've called on Kinsey Wilson to help explain. He's NPR's Senior Vice President of Digital Media. And Kinsey, Mr. Robinson mentions DoubleClick.com, FacebookConnect.com, 5 others. Explain for us first what a cookie is, please.
The first thing to know about a cookie is it is indeed anonymous. It doesn't contain any personally identifiable information. It's really a bit of text that remembers an action that you performed on the site. So when you come back the next time, that information is there and it's easy to navigate the site.
Why would NPR use them then?
If you log into the site so that you can put comments on the site, for example, it would use a cookie to remember your login so that you don't have to enter that information each time you come back.
Michael Robinson seems to have some real privacy concerns about these cookies. Kinsey, do you think those concerns are legitimate?
The way we try to address those concerns is being completely transparent about how we use this information and how cookies are used on the site. Different users are going to have a different threshold for what information they want stored about their behavior on the internet. For some, it's convenience. For others, they see it as an intrusion. We try to be clear about that. And at the end of the day, the user can turn off cookies completely and not use them if that's their preference.
Okay. Kinsey, thanks very much.
Okay.
Kinsey Wilson is Senior Vice President of Digital Media here at NPR. Thanks for all your comments, whether they're posted at npr.org or sent to us by clicking on the link that says Contact Us.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The big event in the world of technology today is the launch of Microsoft's newest computer operating system, Windows 7. Reviewers are saying it's pretty good. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports on how important this is to Microsoft.
Microsoft made its name and stunningly large sums of money as the undisputed king of personal computing. But today, Apple leads in many products and Google leads in searches. Still, operating systems matter. How fast, smoothly, and seamlessly they work makes a huge difference. Everyone panned Microsoft's last operating system, Windows Vista, when it was released nearly 3 years ago, and Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer seems downright relieved that Windows 7 is going on sale.
Well, what I like best as CEO of Microsoft is that it's been relatively well received, I would say, during the course of the review process. What do I like best as a user? Simpler, faster, more responsive.
Windows 7 was extensively pre-tested. Even Ballmer's teenage son offered his input. Still, many critics have suggested that while solid, the new operating system is little more than what Vista should have been. Microsoft hopes Windows 7 will boost both consumer and corporate sales, and says Mary Jo Foley, editor of ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog.
It's really important that Windows 7 is a big success for Microsoft because Windows is basically their key product.
Income from Microsoft's Windows and Office products drives the company's overall profits, its growth, and its ability to adapt and innovate. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.